Do you want to introduce me, or shall I just go?
I'm just going to introduce yourself.
So, as most of you probably know, I'm Rupert Reed. Hello. And so the title I picked for today is What is Liberty? And basically, what I want to do is just share with you some thoughts that I've had on this that I'm really very much in the process of developing, so I'm very much welcome input. So some of you are probably familiar with Isaiah Berlin's classic article, Two Concepts of Liberty. And in this article, Isaiah Berlin, one of the major British political philosophers of the last century, develops this idea that there are two radically different versions of liberty, which he calls negative liberty and positive liberty. Negative liberty is roughly freedom from interference, freedom from constraint by other people. The sort of classic conception of liberty that was mostly defended by liberals in the 19th century. And positive liberty is freedom to do this and that, the ability to achieve such or so and so. And controversially, Berlin associates that with the ideas of socialists and others who said that people should be empowered who are currently restricted by the class system or by lack of access to resources and so on and so forth. And Berlin said that this was a dangerous vision, that positive liberty, that pursuing positive liberty could easily lead to tyranny because you would restrict many people's liberty in order to assist the liberty of those who you were trying to make free to do such and such or so and so. So what Berlin's article in many ways amounted to was a kind of defense of classical liberalism. The trouble with that being, as many people see it, that this is a tacitly right-wing view that defends privilege because you're suggesting that people should just be allowed to do whatever they want, subject to the harm principle or what have you. And you're not suggesting any kind of change in societal resources or organization to enable those people who perhaps don't have any very great deal of economic freedom, for example, to get more such freedom. Now, my thinking is that Berlin is at least onto something in thinking that there are very different things that we mean by liberty, or at least, let's put it this way, very different things that we should mean by liberty. If one has some kind of classic libertarian view of liberty and says that liberty is all about just people being free to do whatever they want to do, and it's got nothing to do with, for example, redistribution of wealth so that some people who are constrained to work really hard, or wage slaves, whatever, could have a bit more freedom in their life. That if you have that kind of vision of liberty, then you have a narrow vision of liberty. But then the problem, it seems to me, is that, and this again is kind of suggested by Berlin's terminology, if you have negative liberty and positive liberty, and they're very, very different, it could be completely opposing ideas in terms of what they recommend, then how much coherence is there, really, to the idea of liberty? And that's really the hard question that I want to ask today. We're accustomed to thinking that liberty or freedom is, at the very least, an idea that makes sense, and an idea that has generally a positive valence. But I want to question those two presumptions. Is it actually a good thing, always, or even usually, for people to be freer rather than less free? And even more radically, does the question of what liberty is and of what it is for people to be free rather than unfree, does it have one coherent answer, or does it just have lots of conflicting answers? So let's think about this in relation to a few kind of areas or examples. So in relation to the political liberties, for example, political freedoms, what are often called civil liberties, well, it seems pretty clear to me, and perhaps to all of you as well, that most civil liberties are generally a very good thing. And that's just fine. Although let's note that in order for people to have genuine civil liberties, genuine political liberties, there may be a great number of interventions to constrain others' liberties, to prevent the political liberties of the majority being infringed upon or eliminated. What do I have in mind here? Well, for example, if you have a so-called free press, as we do in our society, where anyone's free to own a newspaper. Obviously there's a problem in that that freedom is very much a kind of notional freedom. It's what Marx called a bourgeois freedom, if the distribution of wealth is radically divergent, right? In other words, roughly speaking, any of us in this room have the freedom to run a newspaper, but my guess is that none of us in this room does that freedom actually mean terribly much, because we don't have the capital to create and launch and run such a newspaper. So Rupert Murdoch's freedom to own a newspaper is a lot more consequential or real, if you like, than my freedom or your freedom to own a newspaper. So even within the field of political liberties, we see that in order to have genuine political liberties, you may need to massively constrain other liberties. So let's come to some of those liberties, economic freedoms, and this is where I think you have the real battleground. Because in this area, it seems to me deeply non-obvious that things that are called liberties are generally a good thing. And it seems very clear that liberties conflict with and constrain one another. So the greater the freedom of a factory owner or manufacturer or trader, very often the lesser the freedom of the workers or the farmers or whoever who are dependent upon that manufacturer or trader. Is it a good thing for there to be maximal economic freedom in a society when you consider that in relation to environmental aspects of that society or of the people living in that society? Extremely non-obvious that it is, to put it mildly. The situation we're in the world today seems to be roughly a situation in which there is a great deal of liberty for capital, and as a result, as a direct result of that, there are large degradations of our environmental surroundings going on. Is maximizing consumer choice prima facie a good thing? Well, there's actually quite a lot of good psychological evidence now that it isn't. For example, there's these quite interesting experiments done where people are offered a choice between 6 different kinds of jam, I think, or 20 different kinds of jam. And the people who are offered the choice between 6 different kinds of jam, find it easier to choose. B, enjoy the experience of eating the jam that they do choose more. C, are less likely to regret the choice that they made. And D, are more likely to buy more jam afterwards, or to buy any jam at all. That's just one example of many, which suggests that we have in the world we live in today a kind of a surfeit of choice. So there can be such a thing as a surfeit of freedom, too much liberty, even in that quite straightforward, defined domain that I've just given an example of. So what does this all boil down to? Well, what it suggests to me is that we have no prima facie reason for thinking that liberties are generally, certainly not invariably, a good thing. We have strong prima facie reason to think that liberties conflict with each other, and that in answer to the question, well, what's the thing to do here which is best for freedom, or which will be most conducive to liberty, very often the answer is, well, you pay your money and you take your choice. There, you could say this is, but then you're ignoring this cost over here, or you could say that is, but then what about this? That asking the question, what's the best thing to do from the point of liberty, or how can we make people more free by doing such and such or so and so, is very often a question with no good answer. Now, of course, I'm not denying that the concept of liberty ever has a good role to play. As I said earlier, for example, in the field of political liberties, of civil liberties, I think we can at least say that, generally speaking, more is better than less, even if there are immense complexities in terms of the other liberties that will need to be constrained in order to have meaningful political liberties. But if what I'm saying is right, then really the weight is going to have to fall on what kind of liberties we think are good and what aren't. And then the weight is going to have to fall on the reasoning for that. So what I'm getting at there is that it's not good enough to just say, let's try to maximize liberty, or let's do what would make people more free. Sometimes it's pretty clear what's going to make people more free. If you're in the Arab world at the present time, quite a lot of your choices are relatively clear. You side with a ruthless, oppressive, violent government, or you seek to overthrow that government. And the cause of liberty or freedom, it's fairly easy to see which side to come down on. But there are many, many cases, and I would say, actually, the vast majority of cases, which are not like that. So to come to the deepest question, if we're to talk about liberty or freedom, what I've suggested is that most of the time, it's just not good enough to talk about it in the abstract. Right? You have to talk about what kind of freedom in respect of what, and you have to think you have to consider the possibility that the freedoms that you're talking about or that you should consider may conflict with each other, and that freedom may conflict with other very, very important values, which I think is a point which is widely understood. So we could ask the question along the following lines. Liberty of what? Or freedom of what? Now, the reason I phrase the question that way is because it mirrors a famous question that's been asked by Ronald Dworkin and other political philosophers of equality. So Dworkin and other political philosophers have said, okay, so equality is a value that most of us cherish. But we have to ask, equality of what? Right? Do we mean equality of opportunity? Do we mean equality of resources? Do we mean equality of happiness? Do we mean equality of outcome? There are all these different things that equality can mean. So it's supposed to, when people say, I want to make a more equal society, the response which clever political philosophers often give to them is, well, yes, but you have to say equal in respect of what? Otherwise you haven't really yet told us anything. Now, I think this point of view is sometimes exaggerated. It seems to me that actually there are some things where it's reasonably easy to say equality of that wouldn't be enough. That wouldn't be real equality. Equality of opportunity is a classic example. If we only have equality of opportunity, I'm inclined to say, we would not have equality. The things that we mean and that we most care about, that matter to us most in relation to equality, are not exhausted or not sufficiently supported by equality of opportunity alone. So it seems to me that equality is actually a relatively robust value. I accept that there are still arguments to be had between equality of resources and equality of outcome, for example. But it seems to me there's only sort of a few candidates with regard to equality for what really matters. But with regard to liberty, there are an innumerable number, as I hope to have given some reasons for thinking what I've said so far. So if we think that the question of equality of what is at all a good question, then we ought to ask the question, liberty of what? Liberty of conscience? Liberty of economic capacity? Liberty of our society as a whole? Collective liberty? Can there be collective liberty? It seems to me that there can. It seems to me, for example, that what democracy really means could be quite reasonably construed as collective freedom. But if there can be collective freedom, we typically start off by thinking, oh, freedom, yeah, that's something that accrues to individuals of one way or another. If there can be collective freedom, that radically conflicts with many versions of individual freedom. So you see what I'm driving at here. I think that equality is actually a key value and virtue, which people often say, and rightly so, can be in opposition to what people are calling for when they call for individual liberty. And I think it's true to say that there are some sort of internal disputes and internal complexity with inequality, but I'm suggesting actually not that much. But I want to suggest that the internal disputes within liberty are absolutely vast and overwhelming and inexhaustible. And one way of seeing that is to say, okay, so equality of what? Well, what about liberty of what? And the number of things that you could be talking about when you talk about liberty are almost innumerable, and many of them conflict with each other, and some of them are not good or at least many of them are not good at some of the time. So my question, my opening question was, what is liberty? And where I'm driving at with this is I think it's pretty unclear what the answer is. We think we have some kind of idea of what liberty is, but our idea, the more we press upon it, and the more we try to base societal decisions upon it, the less reliable we find it, the more we find we have to bring in other things to explain or to justify what's good about a certain liberty that we want to defend. That when it comes, for example, to economic liberties, it's very unclear that most economic liberties are a good thing at all. And many of them conflict with other economic liberties or with other liberties that we claim to think are important. Deeply conflict, irresolvably conflict or work against. So I think the answer to the question, what is liberty, is extremely unclear. I think that if you ask the question, liberty of what, as you should, you're opening a vast can of worms. You can't close in the way that you can perhaps close the can after a little bit of work if you ask the question, equality of what. And I think what this really boils down to is we have to start to reassess the foundational value of liberty that we think is present in a society such as ours, and perhaps even more so in a society such as the United States. And I think if we did that, this would be consequential and philosophically healthy and necessary and politically revolutionary, because it would mean that the strong rhetorical weight which many politicians, but especially politicians from the political right, gain from the concept of liberty would be thrown radically into question. So that's really what I wanted to put before you, and I'd be interested to know what you think.
Okay. Did anyone have any questions straight off the bat? Okay. I'm interested to know whether, I mean, presumably you're not saying we should do away with it completely. No. So if we were going to use values in its place, what sort of ones? I mean, you said equality already, obviously, but what else perhaps would you put in its place?
Yeah. Okay, so that's a very important question, and obviously a big question. So, to start off with, absolutely, I'm not saying dispense with liberty, stop talking about it, etc. My first recommendation, if you like, would be, if we are going to use this term, liberty, then we need to be more specific. Liberty of what? Liberty in respect of what? Why is this liberty a good thing? Because when people talk about liberties or freedoms, they virtually always assume that what they're talking about is something good. And I'm saying that has to be argued. Why is this a good thing? In respect of what is it a good thing? And that's why I suspect that the rhetorical kind of force behind the general idea of liberty is misplaced. Because many liberties are not good things. Or at least not some of the time. So that's the first thing. And that kind of leads into the fuller answer to your question, I think, Ian, because once one starts to specify in respect of what the liberty that one wants to invoke is a good thing, one will bring into view that other values. So if one is arguing, for example, that our democratic freedoms are a good thing, then I think one will start to see how and why we value democracy in and for itself, how we think it's a good thing for people together, not as individuals, that's not what democracy means, people together to decide how they shall be ruled, to decide that for themselves rather than have that decision be, for example, made for them by an autocrat who has enormous freedom at the cost of their collective freedom. If the liberty in question is economic liberty, it might be that the reason for arguing that this is a good thing is to do with the satisfaction of people's wants and needs and meeting the requirements of that people have for living or for living healthily or something. That, of course, is going to be have to be argued, right? Are the benefits in terms of health or producing an efficiently running economy, are those worth the costs in terms of environmental damage or in terms of wage slavery or whatever it might be. So I think once you start to say it's not enough to talk about liberty, you have to be specific. Liberty of what and why? Then you start to see what are the other values, the other things that we value that complement or indeed are more fundamental than liberty. I think democracy is an independent value. I think that equality is a very important independent value. I could go on and on, and I could talk about love and caringness and so on and so forth. I'm inclined to think that there are a number of things which are better places to look in terms of what is important to human beings and what is important in terms of doing the right thing and what is important for a polity than liberty. And I think roughly that liberty, as I've described, that liberty itself, well, you can't really say liberty itself. Liberty itself isn't really anything at all. It's just a sort of empty space waiting to be filled by something specific. So in that sense, I think in the end it's kind of misleading to say that liberty conflicts with other values, because I think that until you've specified what kind of liberty you're talking about, you're not really talking about anything specific at all, I want to emphasize that, when you invoke liberty. You're invoking some kind of completely vague idea which has a sort of rhetorical and historical kind of attraction. And perhaps an attraction that specifically relates to our state as infants. George Lakoff makes an interesting suggestion that perhaps one of the reasons why liberty appeals to us so much as a value is because when we were very young children, we were so massively, massively dependent upon others and had very little even freedom of movement or anything like that. But of course, if you want to create a good society, it's probably not a very good model for creating a good society to think, well, what kind of society would a 2-year-old design?
Okay, cool. Anyone? Yeah, I've got a question, so I've not fully thought through yet. First, going back to the concept of liberty, and you're saying that we have to specify liberty of what?
Yeah.
I don't know that much about reading science, so I might be invoking him in a terrible way here. I'm also thinking about family resemblance, is it? Maybe it's, you know, a sort of network of ideas that are similar in some of those cases, like you said, economic liberty and equality and opportunity and all that. On the other side, though, maybe we just need to simply say, look, we're using this word too many times in too many different ways, and we need to narrow it down and say, look, from now on, it means this in this context, and keep it at that. So when a politician says, you know, we champion liberty, right, so what do you mean by that? Okay, well, they need to set out and say, look, we mean you can have freedom of opportunity or democracy, you know, specify something by it and stick to it.
Yeah, but how are you going to do that?
I don't know.
Is that going to be like in France? They try and do this. They like have, you know, they have people who are empowered to sort of try to put limits on the language and what words you can use and what words you can't use. But it's very hard to see how this can ever work in what we call a free society, which I think would perhaps be better called a democratic society, where people together decide how to do things. But if there's a substantial minority that wants to speak in a certain kind of way, you don't want to make a tyrannical ruling against them, do you, and say, well, no, you know, that's not allowed. Going back to your opening point, yeah, sure, we could try to say that liberty is a family resemblance concept. And there's been some quite interesting good work done on thinking of liberty as a kind of variant on that, what's called sometimes an essentially contested concept. A concept that different people necessarily have different visions of. The vision of liberty that people on the political right have is necessarily different from the vision of liberty that people on the political left have. And this kind of comes back once again, perhaps to Isaiah Berlin's notion of, you have the people on the right tend to favour negative liberty, people on the left tend to favour positive liberty. But then notice how different this is from Wittgenstein's family resemblance concept idea, at least as he puts it forward. So Wittgenstein says things like, to gain is a family resemblance concept, because you can't have a kind of definition, a useful definition of a game. You just have to say games have all sorts of resemblances with each other. If you see one game, you can see something else which is kind of similar to it, and that's a game as well. But the problem with instances of liberty is that the different uses conflict with each other, right? That one liberty conflicts with another liberty, and some people think that one counts and another doesn't, or even some people think that one is a liberty and the other isn't. So it's much more kind of internally contested than the classic Wittgensteinian family resemblance concept. So that's probably why you led on to your second point, to say, well, then why don't we just ban some of the uses? But I don't think that's going to work. So where does that leave me? Where does that leave us? Well, the first thing to say, I think, is we have to try to get clear about this. Right? We have to try to reflect on the very different ways in which the word liberty is used. And we have to try to get people to be specific. So it's not so much a matter of saying, you're not allowed to use the word liberty that way, but rather of saying to them, okay, so you've used the word liberty there. Now, I need to know more from you in order to understand what you mean. When you just say liberty, so far you kind of haven't said anything at all. It sounds like you said something very grand, but actually you haven't really said anything at all. So it's kind of one issue is an invitation to the other person. Explain to me what you actually mean when you use this word. And that is actually kind of what I think we should be doing. What I think we'll find when we do that is that a lot of the time the weight falls off the term liberty onto whatever else it is that the person in question is defending or arguing is a good thing. And that's kind of where I think we ought to be heading, away from kind of vague invocations of liberty towards demanding a greater specificity, and then towards that showing us what is meant, or what else is meant, if you like. And that might lead us into other concepts, as I've mentioned, such as equality or democracy or well-being or kind of instrumental values of various kinds of lacks of restriction or various things like that. You know, what do you think?
No, I don't think I agree with that, but if I could just...
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Going back to the question of when you're saying, you know, we sort of talk about liberty, it's always a good thing, you said, no, it's not, sometimes there are times where it might not be a good thing. One of the reasons why we might think of it as a good thing, and this is probably not an answer we like, is I'm thinking slightly here about Nietzsche, protection of the weak, slave morality, that kind of thing. Linked to that, I mean, you were talking about when you're a child, and your freedom, you're very dependent on others, maybe your parents, or whatever. Maybe there's also sort of working differently to that. Maybe there's a different notion whereby freedom lets you get what you want. Now, we always certainly want certain things. Some of them go against our morals or our society or whatever.
Mm.
And maybe one of the reasons we like liberty is because it's precisely that getting what you want about something. Which then ties into Nietzsche's point, that maybe there's not some sort of, you know, objective good about liberty. It's rather a case of, we quite are getting what we want, so we'll champion this concept in some sort of empty way that lets us get what we want without having to really expect what we want.
Well, look, I think that's right. But I think we have to think a bit more sophisticatedly than that in terms of where that leads to. So some of you may know the film Fight Club. So Fight Club, one thing that's going on in Fight Club is that it's an exploration of what happens if you get what you want. It's a critique of consumerism, right, in that way. It's a critique of the protagonists, IKEA-based, etc., lifestyle. and a kind of suggestion that actually the he only starts to get somewhere in his life and escape this kind of fundamental existential malaise when he gets into a position where he's not simply getting everything that he wants, but is in fact radically constrained. There is, I think, very good reason to believe that satisfaction of desires is not enough to create happy, healthy human beings. And this is a massive flaw at the heart of consumerism and neoliberalism and of liberalism as well. And it suggests rather that we need to think about needs, and we need to think about collectivity. One could think here about the possible relevance of Buddhism, for example, with its critique of desire satisfaction. So, yes, a central reason why we're attracted to liberty as a value or as a goal is because we like getting what we want. But we need to notice how getting what we want is not something which in the end makes us happy and has all sorts of other disastrous consequences in terms of environmental degradation, decay of collective social institutions, all the kind of bad things that come from an excessive level of individualism. Now, if we push to a slightly deeper level here, sort of psychologically and historically and so on, it seems to me that one thing that is pretty clear is that the reason why the ideology of liberty is so successful in the contemporary West is because it has been pushed and propagandized for by economic forces that have an interest in it being pushed. The idea that we are a consumer society, right, is itself a product. Consumerism is the most brilliant product of the admin and who they're, and the PR agencies and who they're working for, which is people who want to sell you stuff. So consumerism has been produced, and we shouldn't really say that we live in a consumerist society. We live in a producerist society, and only a deeply producerist society would be foolish enough to believe that it is a consumerist society. Consumerism is a brilliant ideology to defend the naturalness of the value of liberty. But I think, going back to my remarks about two-year-olds, we can go even deeper than this. Isn't there likely to be some kind of sense in which the way in which we value this abstraction of liberty, which I've suggested really is just an abstraction until you fill it out, isn't this some kind of rebellion against the deep truth of the extent to which we are dependent upon one another, interdependent, co-constitutive, totally dependent upon forces radically outside our control, including environmental forces? Because it's not just two-year-olds who are thoroughly dependent on people around them. It's actually everybody. Alistair McIntyre argues this very beautifully in some of his recent work, for example. If you try to imagine kind of being a hermit in our society, I mean, it's completely absurd. It's completely absurd. So if you try to imagine being a hermit, right, you're giving up your any involvement in the vast, vast food distribution networks we have. You're obviously giving up the internet, the public health system, the education system. And I could go on and on and on and on and on. The amount that is available now to a pure, kind of isolated individual, it's completely negligible. It's far less than it was even a few centuries ago, when it was already virtually nothing. So is it not that the way we are inclined to value liberty, is it more than just being a kind of reversion to our kind of sense of ourselves as we were when we were two years old? Isn't it also a kind of rebellion against the state of actually existing in a society where we are utterly interdependent with others and co-constitutive of them and of the society? And sometimes I think Nietzsche here can lead us in the wrong direction, because Nietzsche can quite easily lead us in the direction of a kind of triumphal, grandiose individualism which is exactly the kind of thing I've just been criticising. So I'm inclined to think that if we really try to think deeply, psychologically, philosophically, historically, about the concept of the individual, about where our kind of unthinking valorization of liberty comes from, I think things could start to look very, very different from the way that they currently look.
I think perhaps in a similar vein to that, not quite the same, you could perhaps talk about a difference between superficial and a sort of more kind of deep liberty. You were talking about the jam before, and having like 20 pots of jam in front of you makes it much, much harder to decide. And something that I think a lot, that is kind of similar to that, a lot of people do is waste time on computers, perhaps. The fact that if you go on the internet, you've got absolutely everything in front of you, and you can just spend like hours and hours and hours going through loads and loads of rubbish that you really don't actually need to look at. But really you're just doing the same thing all the time. I think in a sense, the fact that you've got so much freedom there sort of, I think, really restricts what it is that you can actually do.
Yeah, good, yeah. So that's another version of the kind of circuit of freedom point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course I agree with you that if we are going to talk about freedom, then we need to distinguish between shallow freedoms and deep freedoms. So consumer choice is a shallow freedom, the kind of freedom that people are fighting for in the Arab world right now, and here as well, with the Occupy movement, whatever. That's a deeper freedom. But I guess the part of my point is, at least with the shallow freedoms, it's sort of reasonably clear what you're talking about. When you get onto the deeper freedoms, it starts to become harder and harder to simply say, well, look, this is freedom, this is what freedom really means. Whereas the deeper freedoms, they ought to be the ones that really are what freedom really means. What do I mean? So part of what I mean is that what we're calling the deeper freedoms are more deeply collective than the shallow freedoms, right? So you can make sense of kind of the shallow freedom of consumer choice by just sort of seeing you picturing yourself in front of these jams, right? Now, when we're talking about the deeper freedoms, then many of them, at least, are essentially available only to collectivities. So the kind of freedom that one can attain in democracy is a classic example. But also, if you're thinking about intellectual freedom, right? Is it really possible to have intellectual freedom by yourself, or for yourself? Isn't intellectual freedom something that essentially comes from dialogue, from genuinely listening to others' voices, considering different points of view, standing on the shoulders of giants, building on everything that's gone before you, being part of a kind of community of ideas, etc. And when we think about intellectual freedom, it can be easy to get sort of tricked, I think, into thinking, well, intellectual freedom, well, that's something essentially for individuals. You know, it's about my mind. And the mind isn't, what could be a more individual thing than that? Actually, the mind isn't that individual a thing in that sense. Desires and their satisfaction, that's somewhat individual. I wouldn't want to overdo it. But the mind is actually a fantastically social thing. Right? The mind is this kind of gigantic commons that to a very large extent we share in common with each other. At any rate, if our mind is anything more than a very sort of crude, simple desire satisfaction machine, yeah? If our mind is a kind of philosophical mind, if our mind is a mind which I'm inclined to call a free mind, yeah? I had a mind that has actually overcome the traps and the unfreedoms which are laid down for us by our language and by our culture and so on and so forth, then it thoroughly involves other people, their understanding, their insights, their relations with one, etc. So, you know, I'm quite happy talking about collective freedoms, but I think if we do talk about collective freedoms, social freedoms, we have to recognize how radically different that is from the things that we usually call freedoms, or from our sort of stereotype of what liberty is, which tends to be something individual. And that just underlines, I think, my point that that this concept of liberty by itself really doesn't get us very far at all.
I think perhaps going back to it's kind of on a slightly different topic here, but you were talking about the clarification of the concept of liberty before.
Yeah.
I feel like there could be a pretty strong role for art and literature in that. So, say you've got a book that projects a particular image of liberty and sort of gets under the skin of the kind of broader social consciousness. And perhaps that's not the right way of framing it. I feel just that the images that these things that works of art put forward can definitely skew your concepts in that way. And perhaps the same for political propaganda. I think that's definitely one of the reasons that the concept of liberty has been given such significance.
Yeah, interesting. I'm trying to think of examples. Of course, there's Jonathan Franzen's recent novel, Freedom, which is a pretty good novel, I think. And he's certainly quite interested in the way that that freedom is not something simple. I'm teaching some very good films this semester, which in some cases are interested in what unfreedom is like. So for example, the Nolan's film Memento, and Alain Resnais's film last year in Marienbad, I think very much about unfreedom. But they don't, they're sort of, well, like I said, they're interested in unfreedom. It's not like they kind of end up saying, and this is what freedom would be. They're kind of telling you what it is to be not free. But arguably that's a very different thing and a sort of a much easier thing than telling you what freedom is. Pointing out to you what's bad or what you ought not to do or what's a terrible condition to be in doesn't immediately kind of tell you what would be a good or a happy condition or what we ought to be aiming at. And it's that I'm really interested in. And I think that talking about freedom or liberty doesn't actually get one very far towards that. Can you think, or can anyone else think of other good examples of art or literature or films that can help us think about the nature of liberty? I'd be interested to know if people have any they know about or think might be relevant.
I think perhaps this idea of books about talking about unfreedom could well be quite useful. I mean,
yeah.
Things like 1984 or any other sort of dystopian kind of conception of the way the world could be.
Yes.
You could think of that as defining liberty by a process of exclusion, like there are all these different ways that you could not be free, and then freedom is just whenever you're not constrained in one of these ways.
Yeah, I think there's something right about that. The problem is that when you try to spell that out, you're nevertheless faced, I think, with a sort of radical indeterminacy. Or else you have to make kind of difficult choices. So a society where people really are a lot more equal than they are in our society would necessarily be a society either that was somehow spontaneously based on kind of love and reciprocity and so on, which would be great, but we're a long way away from that, or a society which was actually more constrained and regulated at a superficial level than our society is. But what somebody like Noam Chomsky says in his criticism of the media, etc., in our society is that we fail to notice how strongly the media in our society is controlled and how deep the forces of propaganda are and so on and so forth. So only if you think that we've kind of actually realized here in our society a kind of utopia, would you think that our society as it is could be a good example of the kind of thing that Orwell was hoping for? And to find a really good example of what Orwell was hoping for, you're still going to have massive, massive constraints on what people normally call liberty. I don't see any way around that. I guess what I think happens with really good novels or films, and this applies quite generally. I'm thinking of a lot of the films that I'm going to be teaching this semester, so like Blade Runner and the Nolan's films and René's films and the work of Kotze or Ishiguro. I guess what I think about a lot of these works, just like about good philosophy, like Nietzsche's philosophy or Wittgenstein's philosophy, is that it delivers you, or at least gives you the opportunity of garnering for yourself a greater intellectual freedom, and that can lead to real freedom in real life, the capacity to resist the status quo, to understand how normal assumptions that are widely made in our society or in other societies may be wrong. That's what's going on in Blade Runner or in Never Let Me Go, for example. But again, I want to say it's an illusion to think that such intellectual freedom that literature and film can foster is an individual achievement and an individual liberty. I think it comes best when it comes collectively. It is almost always kind of mediated sort of dialogically, and most obviously of all, you're getting the freedom that you get there, the intellectual freedom that you get there, from something which is being produced by somebody else. Yeah? And to think that one can do all of this for oneself is, again, just a gigantic, gigantic illusion. But that's the kind of illusion, I think, that getting too stuck on, if you like, libertarian thinking is likely to foster. Maybe that's unfair to libertarians. Maybe they think, well, no, what would be best is if we all maximize our own individual freedom and then sort of offer each other the products of our own thinking and so on and so forth. I guess what I would say to that is to have a society like that which actually is going to function is going to involve either a lot of goodwill or a lot of constraint, and probably both. And that's not usually something which libertarians like to hear. They think it's going to be natural and not require a lot of constraint.
I think with this idea of constraint, there's got to be the worry about who is actually imposing these constraining rules. They've got to come from somewhere. I mean, if you're in a democratic system, obviously you're going to say, okay, it's all of these people voting, and from that you get representatives, and these people put in these laws. So I think there's a certain worry that in a society that's perhaps got a country-sized society with millions and millions of people, that still doesn't feel particularly free, because I mean you've got like one vote, and then things will change kind of as they would have changed anyway, in a sense. I mean, I'm not saying that democracy is bad, but that perhaps you would want to have it in a smaller framework.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the first thing we need to do here is we need to think about what we mean by democracy, right? So for me, I go back to the etymology. Demos, krasi, the people govern, or the people rule. That's what it's supposed to mean. So do we live in a democracy? We assume that we do. Do we live in a society where the people govern or the people rule? I think it's pretty obvious that we don't. So we need to radically deepen the democracy that we have. And that's going to mean things like massive constraint on the economic freedom of corporations and of big finance and of the owners of media. It's going to mean reforms internal to the political system, a fairer voting system, etc. It's also, as you suggest, I think, going to mean that we're going to have to localize things more, because there's a limit to how much democracy you can have when you're working within a massive unit. What you want to have is a system where people understand the system, they feel a sense of buy-in to the system. They're actually there, and they feel that sense of buy-in for good reason. that's going to be a lot more true and a lot more meaningful if you have a much more localized system, much more small scale system. So I think that true democracy necessarily requires a kind of reversal of globalization down onto the local level, and then you can have more participatory democracy, which is in the end a more satisfactory form of democracy than representative democracy. As you say, whenever there is power being exercised, as it were, from outside or not by people themselves, one has to ask the question, well, is this a good thing? What are the downsides of this, etc.? Another useful sort of definition of democracy, I think, is mutual constraint, mutually agreed upon, not imposed from outside, not imposed against people's wills or better judgment, but a people or a group agreeing themselves to regulate themselves or conduct themselves in a certain kind of way. So that, and the idea that we're actually serious, that the people should rule, the people should govern, is how I think we ought to try to deepen our sense of democracy. And that will apply at a national level, and it will apply at the international level, where we need to have more democratic institutions. But above all, it will work best if we can start making more decisions locally, in smaller groups. What does this all mean in terms of liberty or freedom? Well, if we simply say, as I suggested we could say or should say, democracy is collective freedom, and it would be all well and good. But if people say, no, in order for us to have freedom, then we need to reduce the degree to which there is constraint, even mutual constraint, then it seems to me that such a person is saying something controversial and problematic, and it needs defending. That kind of vision of liberty, which I think is covertly right-wing and overtly individualistic, does stand, I think, in opposition to democracy in its true sense.
Did anyone have any more questions? Then maybe we should move to the poll.
Yeah, sure. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.